Was the Copenhagen Summit on Climate Change a lost opportunity, or did it open the way for future action? And which were the national responses to the outcomes of this summit? On January 7, 2010, the Department of International Relations and the Faculty of Arts of the University of Malta organized a symposium entitled National Responses to Global Action. The symposium was open to all stakeholders and to the student community. Campus FM will broadcast the proceedings in three parts. In the first part, Dr. Isabel Calleja, head of the International Relations Department, will introduce the subject and the keynote speakers.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome you all today to today's symposium on climate change. I would like to open this event by first of all thanking everyone for making today's event possible, including the staff at the Old University, MIRSA, our student association, my colleagues in the department, especially Ms. Valentina Kassar. A special thank you to Dr. Carmen Zamut, who first suggested this symposium and who has worked very hard to put it together, and all our panelists and participants, and of course our audience who are with us today. I would also like to add that unfortunately His Excellency Mr. Zamit Kutaya and Professor David Attard are unable to be with us today due to unforeseen circumstances. I would like to start by introducing to you our speakers for the first session. We have with us today Professor Bergoglio, Director of the Islands and Small States Institute, Dr. Simon Borge, Coordinator of the Environment and Planning Law Unit at the University of Malta, Mr. Peter Gutt from Durham University, and our discussant, Ms. Walker-Lay, who is a correspondent for the Malta Business Weekly. Today's symposium on climate change is extremely timely, since environmental concerns are presently at the top of the agenda, both at the national and at the international level. This has been made possible in part by the dramatic change that has occurred in the study of international relations since the end of the Cold War. We have seen here a paradigm shift away from the old arid debates and the constraints of traditional realist perspectives and the new focus on the institutional, constructivist and legal dimensions of international relations that portray a far more complex global reality. However, one of the greatest changes in the discipline has occurred at the very core of international relations, that is, in the area of security. For though traditional security and conventional warfare focused on the notions of safe and impregnable national borders of sovereign states remains a central tenet of international relations, today a new security agenda has surfaced. This new politics of security has been reformatted to cater for new fluid borders and integrationist political models, threatened by such issues as drug running, money laundering, piracy, illegal immigration, and last but not least, environmental threats. Indeed, reports drawn up by the World Resource Institute, the World Bank, and the UN show that a number of ecosystems are fraying under the impact of human activity, and that these ecosystems in the future will be less able to deliver the goods and services that human life depends on. Shifting between the local and the global evidence also indicates that mankind's use of fossil fuels, deforestation, and land use change has contributed significantly to the greenhouse effect and rising temperatures, which in the long term would lead to climate change that could be devastating for many parts of the world. Additionally, though it was the industrialized and advanced world that set this cataclysmic series of events in motion, statistics show that it is the inhabitants of the poor and developing world that have been most hard hit. Every year in developing countries, over 1 million people die from urban pollution, and twice that number from stove smoke inside their home. Another 3 million die prematurely every year from water-related diseases. All told, premature deaths and illnesses arising from environmental factors are said to account for about one-fifth of all disasters in poor countries. Indeed, the World Bank puts the cost that developing countries face from climate change, everything from crops destroyed by drought and floods to malaria spread by mosquito-infested waters to as high as $100 billion a year. The foremost military power in the world, the USA, and its intelligence agencies now consider global warming a leading threat to national security. As sea levels rise and drought spread, it is conjectured that competition for food and water will also increase in many of the world's poorest nations. According to a 2007 study for the Center for Naval Analysis led by General Zinni, the former CENTCOM commander, these regions will become breeding grounds for instability, for insurgencies and for law wars. To keep out millions of climate change refugees fleeing hunger and conflict, a report commissioned by the Pentagon in 2003 predicted that the USA and other rich nations would likely decide to build defensive fortresses around their countries. In an effort to stem such developments, countries around the world have started to band together in order to come up with global solutions. Foremost among these are the establishment of a basic criteria and set of rules that, if followed, would hopefully reverse the process and result in a healthier and more sustainable environment. Today, there are more than 225 such environmental treaties in force. However, a number of these are never ratified in many countries. Others are shown to be ineffective or unworkable. Some argue that what contributes to the failure of such treaties is the effective lobbying of powerful interest groups who believe that they will be negatively affected by the treaty requirements and therefore do their best to scupper such agreements. Others argue that the environmental agenda is being threatened by skeptics who challenge the scientific basis of extraordinary climate change. The results achieved a couple of weeks ago at Copenhagen, touted as the largest environmental gathering in history, illustrate the difficulty of implementing this agenda. Studies on international relations today place environmental politics at the center of the discipline. This is reflected in the importance given to environmental diplomacy that seeks regional and global consensus on the subject. It is also clear in the key role environment plays in foreign policy making and the efforts of states to adopt a more integrated approach where foreign relations, energy security, peace and security, trade and investment, and development cooperation are brought together in order to seek solutions. Today's conference is an attempt to assess these ongoing developments in the light of the recent Copenhagen summit. Now, our first speaker today is Professor Lino Briguglio. I would like to introduce him to the panel. Professor Briguglio is an economist and is director of the Islands and Small States Institute and also a director of the Gozo Center at the University of Malta. Professor Briguglio has published a large number of studies on islands and small states, one of which is a seminal article on the economic vulnerability of small island states in world development. He has also edited a series of four books on vulnerability, resilience and competitiveness of small states, published by the University of Malta.
Okay, good morning. This is the layout of the presentation. I have 15 minutes, I believe, so I have to rush a little bit. I'm going to start with the issue of small states, small island states, and also refer to the IPCC projections. And I'll finish my presentation by tying climate change with sustainable development. My argument is, even if climate change does not happen, it is useful to integrate climate change adaptation, for example, into sustainable development. Now, at the moment, one of the greatest challenges facing small states is climate change. In fact, many of the conferences on small island states put climate change on top of the agenda. And the main problem is that these states contribute negligibly to climate change. Although 20% of independent states are small states, so one-fifth of the, let's say, members of the UN are small states, however, their population is very small, their land area is very small, and their contribution in terms of greenhouse gases, for example, emissions, to climate change is negligible, but they're going to suffer most. even Malta, which is not low-lying, but of course part of it is low-lying, and these happen to be the beaches where we generate a lot of economic activity, and even with a half a meter sea level rise, we will lose a good proportion of the beaches. We'll have also some cultural assets damaged, and Malta is not a low-lying small island state. Others, like the Maldives, Guyana, Kiribati in the Pacific, are low-lying, so they will lose a very large proportion of the land area. In the case of the Maldives, it's the small island states that started this debate, really. Most of the land area will disappear with a meter of sea level rise. Now, the impact. Okay, next please. Okay, now, the problem with small island states, of course, is not just sea level rise. There are, of course, the chances, increased chances of diseases. I mean, if our climate becomes, let's say, similar to tropical climate, we may have also insects which don't survive in our climate now, but they could survive. There could be intrusions into the sea, different things. So it's not just sea level rise. Okay? Now, one may argue these problems are also faced by larger territories, which is true. These problems are not only problems of small states, but the impact of small states is likely to be the largest among countries, and this was acknowledged by the IPCC. I happen to be one of the lead authors of the fourth assessment report, and there is a special chapter on islands where it is stated very directly that islands, small islands, are going to be the worst impacted. They're going to be heavily impacted when compared to larger territories. Next, please. Now, there are, as I said, various international conferences which deal with small island states. The most important ones are the Barbados Conference in 1994 and the Mauritius Conference in 2005. And if you look at the program of action, you'll see climate change on top of the list. And this is an acknowledgement to the dangers and the hazards that I've just described earlier. Next. Now, the IPCC Fourth Assessment Report proposed some projections which are of direct interest to small island states. Next, please. And first of all, they predict that in the areas where small island states are located, the Mediterranean, the Caribbean, the Indian Ocean, the Pacific, the chances are that there's going to be global warming, which of course brings, ushers in the hazards that I've just described. Next, please. Now, as I said, sea level rise, which is one of the effects of global warming, is a fact. Of course, there are people who say there are areas where the sea level has actually subsided, which is true, but in general, there are various indicators and indications that sea level rise will occur as a result of global warming. It is already occurring, and as I said, for small states, this is a very a major concern, okay? Principally because most of the economic activity, or a large proportion of the economic activity generated in small island states, is on the coast. And it's not just tourism. The ports, even the airports, very often are near the coast. So the coastal areas, which will be heavily impacted, are, of course, one of the concerns associated with sea level rise. Next, please. Now, there are arguments against, you know, the occurrence of climate change. They say, for example, look at what happened at the University of East Anglia. You know, there were those famous emails. There are scientists who say that global warming is not man-made, that it would occur, it's occurring naturally. We don't have to worry. It's not caused by the emissions of gases, etc., etc. Now, I think one of the arguments that should be put forward in this regard is a very simple argument. let's assume you've got 95% chance that the roof of your house does not collapse. So the chances are that it will not. And you have only 5% chance that it will collapse. I'm saying now just 5%. Will you stay in that house? You won't stay in that house. Even a 5% risk is very high. Actually, risk is not symmetrical. If there is a risk of dying and not dying, and the risk is spread 50-50, that 50% risk of dying is much heavily weighted when compared to the risk of not dying. So even a 5% risk is high when there is a life and death situation. Now, the chances of climate change are much more than 5%. Most scientists agree that it's going to happen, and it's actually happening. So there are scientists who, of course, argue that it's not happening, that it's not man-made, but the chances are, I say, much more than 5% that it's occurring and it will continue to occur. So I want to emphasize this point because there are doubters and there is a reason to doubt, but the risk is so high, it could be so catastrophic that even, as I said, a very small risk would be enough for us to take action. Now, next one, please. Now, there are at least 5 arguments which create doubt. For example, first of all, lack of knowledge. One of our students who carried out what is known as a Delphi approach to finding out the awareness to climate change found that experts think that the least aware or the least, let's say, who are preferred to take action are politicians, political leaders, and religious leaders. That's what she found. This is in the perception of experts. Fortunately, in Malta, the religious leaders are taking action. There is a group which is influencing the church, so there is awareness now even among church leaders here. Even in the political field, it was found that the political leaders are often not that aware of climate change. Now, things are changing fast now, okay? The second one is there is some uncertainty from the scientific community, but as I said, the consensus is, so to speak, most of the bona fide scientists believe that it's occurring and it will continue to occur. Then there is the doubt that, yes, it's occurring, but it is not man-made. We can't do anything about it, it's natural. Then there is the worry, which is a real worry, that the expense of mitigation, now I'm sure you are aware that there are two, let's say, major technical words. One is mitigation, which means reducing emissions, and the other is adaptation, taking action to cope with climate change. Now, mitigation is costly, and there are, let's say, worries that it could slow down economic development. This is the argument that is coming from the developing countries. They say to the United States and to Western Europe, you have developed by using petroleum. You have polluted the world. Now, when it's our turn to develop, you're telling us not to do it. We are prepared not to do it, but you've got to pay us. That's a basic argument. And it is a real concern because mitigation is costly and it can slow down economic development. And finally, there is the business interest. If you are a producer of oil, if you are creating machinery which uses oil, etc., etc., if a good proportion of the if a good proportion of the profits come from using oil and emitting gases, then there's a chance that you oppose the idea of climate change. So there are these 5, let's say, positions. Now, next please. Now, these, of course, warrant different answers. For example, lack of awareness. The solution is information. Fortunately, information has grown. Recently, with the Copenhagen meeting, even there is more information. So I think this problem, although it still exists, it's being addressed in a way. Now, when there is lack of belief, this is mostly ideological, it's very difficult to change it. You'll find even in Malta, one of the, for example, you'll find articles in the Sunday Times suggesting that climate change is somebody invented it, you know, out of vested interest, and it's not true. It's almost now an ideological stand. It's coming very often from right-wing sources, but not only. You find very strong arguments, mostly ideological, against climate change. Now, whether climate change is man-made or not, that's to be settled by science, and I think science now has proved the point. There are scientists who actually show otherwise, but in general, most scientists agree that climate change is actually occurring and will continue to occur. Now, the high cost of mitigation, this is a real problem, and I think developing countries have a point. They want to develop, they want to fight poverty, etc., and they need to have this problem addressed properly, not only in Copenhagen. Now, actually, Copenhagen was not the last word. There could be, let's say, conferences that follow where some solution could be found, but I think developing countries have a point. And the business interest, this is also a reality. I think eventually there will be technology which could reverse the situation, but at the moment, the use of oil still remains profitable. It is one of the cheapest sources of energy. So I think the last problem is really an economic problem. And it could change with technological development. Next, please. Now, this is, of course, I continue with the argument here that sea level rise will have very large, that will create large damage on small island states. And I'd like to refer to the third point, where a lot of sociocultural assets, not just tourism complexes, are located on the coast in small island states. And this issue is also of importance. Next, please. Now, we can skip this. Now, when it comes to cost of adaptation, small island states also face problems. Now, I'd like to explain very briefly the problem of indivisibility. When you have a small population, overhead costs are very large. It's like having a school with one headmaster. A headmaster for 1,000 students is cheaper than one headmaster for 100 students. So small island states have this problem of indivisibility of costs. That is, costs are not downscaled according to the population. And that's why the cost of infrastructure in Malta is so high. It's not high in absolute terms, but it's high in relative terms. Now, the cost of adaptation, which require infrastructural changes, stronger infrastructure, is a major problem for small island states. So they're going the ones to suffer most, and they're also the ones to face the highest cost. Okay? And since I have 2 minutes, I will end up by putting forward the argument that even if climate change is not occurring, it's still useful and beneficial to take on board adaptation measures. Adaptation measures generally mean stronger infrastructure. If there is a seaborne hazard like a tsunami, whatever it is, or high waves, or even cyclones, adaptation helps also to mitigate problems from these hazards. So the final point of my presentation is that it is useful to integrate adaptation into sustainable development policies of the country. Now, if you want to receive a copy of my paper, you can find my email address on the university website, and you can send me an email, and I'll send you a copy of the paper. Thank you very much.
thank you, Professor Bourgouillon, for the paper and for indicating the very important warning of how important the impact of climate change is on island states. And of course, for a very colourful analogy vis-à-vis the threat of houses. I'm sure everyone agrees that even 5%, as he said, is a very important statistic. And I would like to now introduce to you Dr. Simone Borge. Dr. Simone Borge completed her Magister's Juris degree in International Environmental Law in 1994, and in 2009 obtained a PhD at the International Maritime Institute. She was for a number of years Press Secretary with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. At the moment, she is during this time, she was made responsible for negotiating Malta's position in international environmental and multilateral agreements, including the Barcelona Convention and its protocol, the drafting of legislation and legal policy making in environmental law. She also coordinated the transposition of the environmental acquis during Malta's negotiations to become an EU member state. She is presently the coordinator of the Environmental and Planning Law Unit at the University of Malta, and she has published many articles and papers on Malta's environmental law.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed a pleasure to be here with you today, although when the organizers first asked me to prepare a paper on the Copenhagen Accord, I was, to tell you the truth, very nervous, because the outcome, as you all know, has been defined as annus horribilis with an horribilis accord, and it was really very very upsetting to see colleagues and acquaintances returning from the protocol, from the discussions to a successor to the Kyoto Protocol, feeling so downcast. But this prodded me to approach this paper with this state of mind. Should I do a post-mortem, or should I try and look into the causes which have made this meeting, which has caused such deficiencies, which has shown such shortcomings, and try to elicit a model which we would perhaps try to find in order to work to find a workable solution. So this explains the title of my paper: Assessing the Copenhagen Accord, Conducting a Postmortem, or Seeking a Paradigm. It sounds like a million-dollar question. Has Copenhagen been a failure or a success? From what we have seen and read these last couple of weeks, opinions expressed differ widely. Unfortunately, or rather fortunately, those who were present might say, I could not make it to Copenhagen. So I had to rely on second-hand, reliable resources to draw up some conclusions on the outcome. The first two documents I received via email in the small hours of the morning on Sunday, 20th December, were the US-Canada summary of the outcome and a short paper assessing the conference and the accord by the chair of the IUCN Academy of Environmental Law, Professor Bob Fowler. Sincerely speaking, I found it very hard to believe that the two documents were actually discussing the same event. So the most convenient answer, at least diplomatically speaking, would be to say that the principal outcome, the Copenhagen Accord and the two supporting decisions of the parties, are neither a success or a failure. On one hand, the meeting of the parties failed to adopt a legally binding agreement. This was no surprise. We had predicted this. It also, however, barely skimmed through many of the core issues on its agenda, set at the Bali meeting, leaving them unresolved. It did not even fulfill the mandate set for it by the same conference of the parties. On the other hand, the meeting did manage at the very last moment to produce a political agreement that ensures, hopefully, continuity in the negotiation process, as well as the possibility of a binding agreement in 1 year's time, as a best-case scenario. In sum, it provides that the Annex I parties must identify by 31st January of this year new commitments relating to emission reductions by 2020. It also establishes that non-Annex I parties, apart from the least developed states and small island states, must identify national appropriate mitigation actions that will be set out in an appendix to the agreement that should be completed at first instance by this date, and then possibly added to the successor of the Kyoto Protocol. Another thing which the Copenhagen Accord provides is that developed countries shall contribute to funding that approaches $30 billion over the next 3 years in order to support both mitigation and adaptation activities in developing countries. But by developing countries, the accord refers mainly that it should be focused on least developing states and small island states. Finally, the Copenhagen Accord provides for a commitment by developing countries to a goal of jointly mobilizing $100 million per year by 2020 for mitigation action, conditional upon transparency with respect to the implementation of mitigation actions, as well as the establishment of a high-level panel to explore potential sources of revenue. And what has been possibly the most innovative and the most positive outcome is the establishment of the Copenhagen Green Climate Fund to support mitigation and adaptation projects under the Convention. So only time really will tell us if the Copenhagen Accord would be honored. So rather than debating its success or otherwise, I wish to devote these few minutes to dwell and hopefully provide some food for thought on what I believe this conference continued to confirm, namely that our planet, our civilization, is witnessing a new geopolitical order that challenges the way international relations and indeed international law presently evolve. Debating whether Copenhagen is a success or a flop, therefore, becomes tantamount either to conducting a post-mortem, if we choose to be pessimistic, and that's the easiest option, or to a soul-searching exercise that realistically attempts to come to terms with the current trends in which international law and international policymaking are currently operating, in order, perhaps, to seek a paradigm that will successfully regulate mitigation and adaptation to climate change. Many states, and being a new member, Malta has in fact been one of them, expressed great frustration regarding the current consensus model for the negotiation of global agreements. And who can blame them? I believe this is the prevailing opinion even amongst most civilians. How can an intensive negotiating process spanning over 2 years, peaking in a fortnight of meetings, simply produce an accord that has not even been endorsed, but merely noted by the parties? It hasn't been endorsed, officially endorsed, as a conference, but there has been a note by the parties that it was made. Many have blamed this upon emerging economies and oil-producing states, accusing them of persisting in political foot-dragging at Copenhagen, or of selfishly refusing to take national measures to address climate change. I believe it goes deeper than that. Observers tend to emphasize the political inertia of present environmental conferences, comparing them to the so-called golden years of international environmental law. The success achieved in environmental treaties at the end of the 80s can never be emulated in our era unless states acknowledge that geopolitically the world has changed. It's not the same as it were 20 years ago at the end of the Cold War. Furthermore, as Professor Beguglio has pointed out very clearly, the climate change issue is sui generis. It's not just any environmental issue. The international community, indeed humanity as a whole, has never had to deal with regulating a threat of this magnitude that additionally and unfortunately seems uncannily similar to a mission involving the detonation of a time bomb. Otherwise, one will end up with a political accord. Sorry. The bottom line is that convening a fortnight-long meeting preceded by intensive preparatory meetings spanning over 2 years may have worked well at UNCED, but has repeatedly fallen short of spearheading states to regulate the widest possible number of politically ultra-sensitive and socio-economically foreboding issues that make up climate change. This situation should, first and foremost, serve to highlight that if we adopt this model, there are no guarantees of success in the next 12 months. It is true that international law and policy is not promulgated via a centralized lawmaking body, so reliance on meetings like Copenhagen seem inevitable. But a more efficient and transparent formula is required than the ones adopted so far. For instance, such negotiations require better representation of all parties. A good number of states are no longer ready to act as bystanders and endorse an agreement concluded by a handful of so-called most affected states at the 11th hour, simply to save the day. A number of parties, which included small island states like Tuvalu, developing states like Bolivia and Pakistan, as well as oil-exporting states like Venezuela, did not succumb to such diplomatic pressure and refused to support the accord presented to them at the end of the conference. This is why the COP was constrained to take note of the accord, rather than calling for a vote. The argument put forward in holding final negotiation with a smaller representative group is that this facilitates progress. However, the truth is that negotiating a deal to address climate change has demonstrated over these last two decades that the traditional political groups like OECD and G77 plus China no longer readily share the same position. It is not breaking news to mention that the rift between the various members of G77 plus China on climate issues, although not so widely publicized, is as deep as that between the EU and the US. So despite the fact that the accord was presented as a sort of a joint position between these two major political groups, some constituent members refused to identify themselves with it. The writing on the wall, therefore, reads that expediency cannot ride roughshod over proper representation. This leads me to delve into the issue of a new legally binding agreement. This has been the biggest disappointment at Copenhagen. There has been no agreement among COP members on a Kyoto Protocol successor. Developed countries favor a new legally binding instrument imposing mitigation measures upon existing Annex I parties and emerging developing economies that right now are non-annex, but this was fiercely opposed. And the group of 77 plus China favor an amendment to the protocol setting new targets for existing Annex I parties, whilst a new instrument would implement the Bali Action Plan. Again, most of the woes of the UNFCCC and the Kyoto Protocol are due to a system which has worked well in environmental multilateral agreements in the past, namely underpinning legal obligations with the state's political status as a developed or developing country. This linkage between capping and political classification, however, is proving very hard to crack now that some developing countries have become themselves major emitters. Copenhagen has managed to break new ground, roping in some of these states, these emerging economies, to adopt voluntary targets. An important achievement. But it does make ethical sense that states experiencing continuous economic growth would start sharing the burden in curbing emissions. It is, however, true to say that besides the generation of fossil fuels at the production stage, there are various other activities throughout the product's lifetime until it is utilized and discarded by the consumer, which contribute to climate change. Many developing countries put forward this counter-argument, supported by NGOs. So states with unsustainable consumption patterns also have to come to terms with effectively implementing the principle of common but differentiated responsibility. The point here is that although emerging economies do have this burden, may start sharing this burden, but there's nothing which compares to their situation with the developed countries which have such high consumerism. The counterargument extends the interpretation, therefore, of the polluter pays to include also the user pays. Such an interpretation would serve as a paradigm that would supersede the anomaly that characterizes the rift in climate change negotiations. I'll come to my conclusion. What I suggest is that another aspect that has been very fundamental to the Copenhagen Accord is civilian participation. Definitely, this has been perhaps the best development since UNCED. However, we have seen what has happened, that although there is a lot of civilian participation in numbers, effectively, that participation is lost when it comes to influencing the negotiations, because obviously the doors of the conference are shut down, there is rioting in the streets, and there's a lot of anarchy and confusion sometimes. So it's time that international law and policy starts working on a procedure, on a legal procedure, how to utilize civilian participation and make it more effective. That would avoid violence in the streets, for instance. But it would also empower more the citizens to influence governments. Last but not least, the urgency of the threat itself requires states to consider a myriad of other legal issues that we haven't even started looking at. For instance, it would be interesting to assess what is the potential of the high seas in producing renewable energy for the benefit of humankind. What legal effect sea level rise would have on the delimitation of maritime boundaries? Indeed, what would happen to those small island states who would lose their territory completely, facing statelessness? In sum, the international community needs to move on beyond Kyoto and beyond Copenhagen. We cannot permit ourselves to feel pessimistic. We must find a solution, despite this division between states. In the end, this is the future. The confirmation lies with the immense interest that cleaner technology production is generating within individual states, like California, for instance, amongst oil companies themselves, car manufacturers. And why not in the specialization of many of our university students in climate change issues? I am convinced that innovation will out. Innovation will change the world. When one thinks about what happened in the past, how perhaps the Pony Express Company in the West, in the US towards the late 19th century, greatly resisted and opposed the invention of the telegraph for fear of losing its competitiveness, less than a century later, humanity sends emails. So will it be with fossil fuels. Whether we will make it or not in time, then, that's another matter. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Borge. I'm going to immediately move over to the next participant because we're running a bit short of time. Our next participant is Mr. Peter Gatt, who is a geologist and researcher at Durham University on past climate change and its future applications, for which he recently received a BP award. He is also a member of the Scientific Committee for Civil Protection and National Correspondent for the International Association of Sedimentologists.
Thank you. Good morning to you all. I'm trying to give a very brief scientific background to climate change in just a few minutes. Climate change is an intrinsic part of Earth history and has been with us for hundreds of millions of years. Earth scientists, especially geologists, have for many decades studied past climate change by looking at effects of sea level change on the sedimentary record. By the sedimentary record, for example, the rocks of Malta. They are all sedimentary rocks. Now, in many cases, changes in sea level can be attributed to climate change, brought about by fluctuations in the Earth's orbital parameters. This is called orbital forcing. What do I mean by this? For example, changes in the Earth's orbit around the Sun, or changes in the angle of the tilt of the Earth. And this generates cycles of global warming and global cooling, which obviously triggers waxing and waning of the polar ice sheets, when we did have a polar ice sheet, because there were periods of time when the Earth did not even have polar ice sheets. Therefore, the sedimentary record is a record of climate change. And we have had that for millions of years. And we can see this in Malta as well. And perhaps this could be helpful for us to extrapolate future climate changes. Now, these past fluctuations in sea level, which we see in our record, of rock record, have been used by climate change skeptics as an argument that there's nothing unusual about the present climatic changes, which are seen as purely natural processes. However, these natural earth processes, which I've been talking about, did occur on a timescale of tens to hundreds of thousands of years. What is remarkable at the present is the rapidity of climate change. And so this is a real threat. It is not the normal business as usual, sort of, when it comes to climate change. Now, there are many ramifications of climate change, and I've sort of abridged the effects of climate change into three outstanding changes. Firstly, the Arctic ice sheet, that is the ice sheet found on the North Pole, is melting rapidly. It is thinning, and satellite photography also shows us that it's also shrinking. Some scientists say that we're going to lose the Arctic ice sheet within 40 years. Secondly, sea levels are rising. They have been rising for quite a long time, but they seem to be getting rising even quicker now, obviously as a consequence of melting polar ice sheets and also melting glaciers. And this is going to have catastrophic effects on certain countries, or I'd say all countries, including Malta. And thirdly, the level of carbon dioxide, atmospheric carbon dioxide, in the Earth's atmosphere is rising. This CO2 has been recorded in an observatory in Hawaii for quite some time now, for a number of decades. So we do have a good record of the rise of CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere. Now, CO2, as we all know, is a greenhouse gas. It is not the only greenhouse gas. Methane is another greenhouse gas. Lots of methane is produced by agriculture. There are also natural emissions of methane gas from the seabed. Very interestingly, there's a lot of research going on now on these aspects, because climate change has triggered lots of investment in research, scientific research. And for example, the area between the seabed, between Sicily and Malta, is an area where there are these methane gas emissions from the seabed. There are other areas in the Caspian, in Indonesia. But coming back to CO2, CO2 has been rising. If we look at the level of pre-industrial CO2, now by pre-industrial I mean 200 years ago. I mean the Industrial Revolution started about 200 years ago. This was the period of time when people started burning coal and later other fossil fuels in combustion engines and so on. You know, the industrialization of Europe, United States and so on. So that started about 200 years ago. So if you go back 200 years ago to about 23 to 20 million years ago, in the early Miocene, the Miocene is a geological epoch, is the period of time when the Globigerina limestone was deposited. This is the rock with which Valletta is built off, most of the island is built off. If we go back to 23 million years ago, we find that the abundance of atmospheric CO2 was around 280 parts per million. There were small fluctuations, but it was on average 280 parts per million. So 20 million years, practically very little changes in CO2. However, in the past 200 years, ever since the Industrial Revolution, the level of CO2 has increased by 100 parts per million. And it's now at the level of about 300 to 390 parts per million. Now, this is not an accident. There is definitely a connection between this rise over a level of 20 million years and man's activities, the burning of fossil fuels. Now, this is not just a statistic. This has greater significance because Earth systems operate on the basis of thresholds. In other words, we have a period of time where there's little change, and then suddenly there's a rapid change. Now, the present CO2 level in the atmosphere already exceeds the threshold for the formation of the Arctic ice sheet. The Arctic ice sheet is the ice sheet we have in the North Pole. In other words, the present level of CO2 is already too high for this planet to have an Arctic ice sheet. There's been a paper published in Nature last year about this. And indeed, the Arctic ice sheet is melting fast. Very bad news for polar bears, which are already drowning. But good news for certain countries. We already see a scramble for the Arctic now. The Russian Federation, Canada, United States, and ironically even Denmark, which hosted the Copenhagen conference, are already making claims over the Arctic. Why? Because the seabed is very rich in hydrocarbons over there. So, you know, we're going to lose the Arctic, and some countries are going to benefit probably from this. This also means that we are heading towards a new scenario, a unipolar world, a world where we have just one ice cap, the Antarctic ice cap, Antarctica and the South Pole. Now, present models of climate change tend to overlook this unipolar world. Indeed, my research in Durham, with another group of researchers there, actually looks at this unipolar world. And we also have analogues of this type of world. If we look back in time, between 30 million to 20 million years ago, if we look at the geological record, we find that the Earth was also a unipolar world. In other words, we just had an ice cap in the southern hemisphere in Antarctica. And we have a rock record here in Malta during that period of time. And I'm actually looking at that and studying, you know, the cycles and the changes in climate that we had at the time. And what's interesting is that rather than climate change, we will probably be experiencing a shift in climatic belts. I think now the evidence is now accumulating towards that, but there's still more research to be done. Now, coming back to the present, the Copenhagen conference. This is considered by many to be a failure. I think the press reviews generally tend to give that impression. Am I right about that? However, politicians did come up with some kind of broad results. For example, this is what I've read, at least, from the press, is that they've actually set a kind of a benchmark for an increase in global temperatures by 2 degrees Celsius. Some people are saying even less than that. But they set this benchmark, apparently, that they want air temperatures, or they would like to restrict air temperatures to an increase of 2 degrees Celsius, which obviously means we are still going to lose the Arctic ice sheet. With consequences to the North Atlantic Drift. Now, the North Atlantic Drift is a current, a sea current, which keeps Northwest Europe warm, Britain, France, Scandinavia, and so on, because it brings warm water from the tropics. So that drift will probably stop as the Arctic ice sheet keeps melting. A 2 degrees Celsius increase in global temperature will be catastrophic for some countries. Bangladesh is one of these countries, millions of people living there, and left most of the country is just about 2 meters above sea level. Other countries like the Maldives, which is a republic made out of many hundreds of coral reefs in the Indian Ocean, is also drowning. Now, this is very strange because the geological record shows us that whenever there was a sea level rise, corals tend to thrive, coral reefs tend to rejuvenate. But what we're having nowadays is the drowning of coral reefs. So there's something more than just sea level rise. It's far more complicated than just a simple sea level rise. Obviously, we can also have runaway global warming. In other words, the 2 degrees Celsius benchmark may be exceeded. And indeed, some countries like China and South Africa, I'm sure, will be very reluctant to give up the coal-fired power stations. And they actually indeed intend to build more of these coal-fired power stations. Why is that? Because coal is readily available, while the supply of oil is getting more restricted. But coal is quite common. It's also common in Europe as well. On the other hand, some countries like the United Kingdom and the Netherlands are thinking of going back to coal-fired power stations as well, with a little difference. In the UK and also in the Netherlands, there's been a lot of research on what's called carbon sequestration and storage. Actually, Durham University is on the forefront on this as well, which means you build your coal power station, but the CO2 emitted is piped into an old oil reservoir where it is stored underground, under the seabed. Now, the North Sea is full of old and disused oil reservoirs under the seabed. And that is what they intend to do. That's what Britain is intending to do, is to build one of these coal power stations and pipe off the CO2 underground in offshore areas. So this is, you know, this is something that still has to be tried, but, you know, companies are working and governments are very interested in this. Now, this could also be interesting for Malta, the Delimara power station, for example. You know, this could be a way out to reduce our CO2 emissions. Now, coming back to Malta, let's see, have a look at the effects of climate change on Malta itself. Now, we know that Malta has set up a climate change committee, which, unlike the British Committee on Climate Change, does not have a singular scientist on this committee, which probably, you know, shows us in which direction we're heading to. In addition, I think I have to add that it is significant that Malta still lacks an organization that studies and documents natural resources and processes. Indeed, Malta remains the only country in the Mediterranean and the European Union, and I would say practically the whole world, which lacks a geological survey or a geological service, as it is now called. Britain was the first country in the world to have a geological survey called the BGS. All other countries in Europe, France, Italy, and so on, Cyprus has one. Israel set up its geological survey 1 year after its independence. Lebanon has reestablished its geological survey after the Civil War. Now, why is this important? Because we have to understand Earth processes before we come up with solutions. Or else, there is a danger of two options, of coming up with the wrong solutions. For example, coming up with solutions which have been tried elsewhere. But the solutions to mitigate climate change elsewhere may not be applicable to a country like Malta. Or else, as sometimes happens, we come up with solutions which are totally unrelated to the problem. Problems of, let's say, coastal erosion or beach erosion have been, I think, a controversy earlier this year about this. And, you know, the authorities came up with solutions which have nothing to do with beach erosion. And nobody mentioned the effects of climate change, sea level rise, which is causing beach erosion in Malta. Now, we do not have ongoing studies in this country on the effects of climate change on Malta and natural forces we have to deal with. So this means that the engineering projects related to climate change may either be under-designed or simply wrongly designed. In other words, we have to know... 2 minutes left. We have to know exactly what we are dealing with before we come up with a solution. Now, again, to summarize, I've come up with 3 points which are, I think, very relevant for Malta when it comes to climate change. I think we have to expect and prepare, rather, for the warming of the Mediterranean Sea. This is already happening. And by the way, warming of the Mediterranean Sea would also mean an expansion of the sea. So that in itself contributes to sea level rise as well. Now, what effect does this warming of the Mediterranean Sea have on us? Well, it will cause greater air instability, which means more storms. Flooding will continue to be a long-term problem, especially since flood relief projects in this country are located in the wrong places. Downstream rather than upstream number of cases. Secondly, we can predict that Malta's sandy beaches will keep on shrinking, getting smaller, and possibly in 10 years' time, the smaller sandy beaches may actually disappear. Coastal infrastructure would also be damaged by increased frequency in storm, and there is scientific data to support the increase in the number of North Atlantic storms. Some of these actually reach Malta as well. And thirdly, Malta's aquifers are being depleted. Now, we already know that there's overpumping of Malta's aquifer, and the groundwater is becoming more saline. But before we speak of a water crisis, we have to keep in mind that the aquifer itself, or the aquifers themselves, are leaking huge quantities of fresh water into the sea. And we are not tapping this huge amount of water which is flowing, naturally flowing to geological structures into the sea. Other countries like Syria, for example, is actually tapping offshore freshwater springs because they have a water crisis as well. So we have to start thinking in new ways. We have to understand natural processes before we come up with solutions. So the main point is this. We can come up with solutions after we know what is the problem. And we need to understand earth processes before we come up with the solutions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gart. I will not comment at this point because we have a discussant who I think can do it much better than myself. So without further ado, I'm going to pass you on to Ms. Walker-Lay, who is an economist and journalist correspondent for the Malta Business Weekly, and has also covered 9 of the last 13 UN climate change conferences. Ms. Lay has 10 minutes, basically, to give you a summary of papers. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think that's an impossible assignment, but that is the journalist's life, you know, summarize trade negotiations in 45 seconds or 300 words. I would just add that I have also been representing Nature Trust Malta within the 450-member global network, Climate Action Network International, which has been very active in the climate change negotiations. So my perspective is really a dual one, perhaps a bit schizophrenic, of both an NGO activist and a journalist at these conferences. I would like to start in perhaps a different order to the one that we have been listening to by just picking up some points from Peter's presentation on science, moving on to Lina's, and then finishing with Simone's. I think that certainly the science of climate change is now looming very large in the negotiations, but we are confronted with two sciences. One is the recommendations of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which, to summarize, say that you need to peak global emissions by 2020 at the latest. You need a 25% to 40% cut in the emissions of the developed nations by 2020. You need to reach a cut of 50% of global emissions by 2050, which would mean an 80% cut for the developed nations. And that science, of course, is dates from 2007, which was itself the product of a peer review of scientific research, as it then was, scientific results of 2004-2005. There is now what is called the recent science, the post-IPCC fourth assessment report science, which in fact calls for much deeper cuts so that you reach a maximum level of 1.5 degrees increase in the global temperature and a concentration of 350 parts per million. Well, the developed nations are sticking very firmly to IPCC 4AR, while 102 developing countries are calling for targets to be geared to the new science. This, of course, injects a new layer of complication into the negotiations. I can't quite agree with Peter that the two degree target has really been locked in by the Copenhagen Accord, because there are actually no numbers on how you would get there or no dates, and we do not have much time to avoid runaway climate change. All that he said about the Arctic is pretty terrifying, and of course many developing countries will actually sink below the waves. And the science is now of great concern, as Isabel already mentioned, to the military. And I think for the first time in Copenhagen, you did have a group of military people who were putting the security side to the issue, as well as veterans, US veterans, warning of the tremendous upheavals you might have in developing countries hit by climate change. As regards to the solutions, Peter, I'm not myself a CCS fan, and I espouse some of the arguments which its opponents roll out. That is that you, CCS is very energy intensive, so you have to build a much bigger power station so it also powers the CCS process. It only captures about 60% of the CO2 which is emitted. The long-term security of geological formations is somewhat in doubt, whether below the sea or below land. And of course, there are only one or two pilot plants so far, so how do you scale up? And this will also cost an enormous amount of money, and here we have the notion of opportunity costs. Could that money not be more usefully spent on other technologies, such as concentrating solar power and renewable energies? There's rather an interesting paper which has just come out from the Major Economies Forum on Energy Technologies, which shows the huge potential for energy efficiency in building and also these new energy technologies. Finally, as regards Malta, I would urge Malta, as a foreigner, to join the project belatedly called Circe, a four-year, 10 million euro project, which is looking at the environmental, economic, and social impacts of climate change in the Mediterranean. It will deliver its headline results next March. It has 62 stakeholder institutions and organizations associated with it. In developing these results, I'm sorry to say that according to the most recent list, Malta is not in that particular list, but I think that it should be. So if it is possible, I think Malta should attend, be represented at, observe at the presentation of these results in March in Madrid. So just to finish on science, I would like to quote from findings of three top research institutes who say that the current offers on the table, which are not actually in the form of possible amendments to the Kyoto Protocol, will deliver global warming of over 3 degrees centigrade by 2100, with concentrations going up to 650 ppm, or if you include all the various gases, 800 ppm. The pledges on the table will not halt emission growth before 2040, let alone by 2015, as indicated by IPCC, and far from halving emissions by 2050, as has been called for by the G8. Global emissions are likely to nearly double 1990 levels by 2040. So I think this gives us an idea of the gap between what the science says must be done and what the politicians so far are doing. Turning now to Lino's very interesting presentation on developing small island developing states. They have in fact emerged as key players in the UNFCCC process. There are now 43 of them. Four of them are in fact territories. They're not independent. That's Guam, Virgin Islands, and two others. And this group has been extremely proactive, and they are championing the lower targets, if you like, or higher targets, depending how you interpret it, of 1.5 maximum temperature increase and 350 ppm. I would like to quote in that regard from the speech of the Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed, who said, "The United States says it opposes the 350 target because technologies do not exist to make it a reality, but I know there is no limit to American ingenuity." So the AOSIS is playing a very key role despite small size. They want the two-track approach, along with other developing countries who refuse to see the elimination of the Kyoto Protocol. As I'm now told that I only have 2 minutes, sorry, I cannot go through Simone's paper in detail. I would simply like to ask her how she visualizes the extinction of the Kyoto Protocol, since this is not provided for in the protocol, and three-quarters of its members, the developing countries, wanted it to go on. As far as the Copenhagen Accord, I think this is a failure dressed up success. The legal character is absolutely unclear, and how the Secretariat or the COP are actually going to deal with it is absolutely unclear, and who is actually going to send in their written support for it is absolutely unclear as well. I would have sympathy with the view that the two main results of Copenhagen were that the work of the two working groups on Kyoto Protocol, second commitment period, commitments and the Bali Action Plan were extended, and they will go on working through the year with the hope that they will come to some kind of agreement by the end of 2010. The Kyoto, the Copenhagen Accord does not provide for a legally binding agreement at any date. Of course, everyone hopes it will come out soon. The only date there is 2015 to review the accord. So if that is all that happens, I'm afraid we are on track for runaway climate change.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, Ms. Lay. Before we finish this panel, I just want to ask the participants whether they would like to respond to anything that Ms. Lay brought up vis-à-vis their papers. I would start with you, Peter.
Okay. Thank you, first of all. A small point about carbon sequestration and storage. This is a new idea, a new technology. And it is very attractive for countries which have a coal supply, like the United Kingdom, for example, and also China as well. So this could be a way forward for some countries. Countries like South Africa are very dependent on coal-fired power stations. Now, it's very difficult to ask South Africa to close these power stations, you know, and being one of the most industrialized countries in Africa. So this could be a way forward. Now I understand that, you know, the technology is not perfect. There's still much research going on, especially in Britain about this. But, you know, it could offer a sort of partial solution, let's say.
Well,
you're working on it.
But meanwhile, you know I'm emitting more and more.
Yes, but the British Minister for the Environment has already pledged the building of a coal-fired power station in southeast England, I believe, in Essex. And the CO2 would actually be pumped off to an offshore oil field in the North Sea. So things are happening. Even in the Netherlands, things seem to be moving in this direction. It may not be the perfect solution, but it is a start. As regards the 2 degrees benchmark increase, now I understand that there might not be an actual agreement on that, but there seems to be some kind of, well, convergence perhaps, I don't know, as regards the Copenhagen conference.
Well, it's like agreeing to get married, but then you never actually get married.
That's right.
No,
I agree with you. I think we're more heading towards runaway global warming rather than yes. You know, some kind of benchmark, you know, set by Copenhagen.
Mr. Thank you. Dr. Borge, please.
Quickly on the first question on the extinction of the Kyoto Protocol. I'm not a fan of the extinction of the Kyoto Protocol. Sorry, the Kyoto Protocol, yes, because what I have to explain is that the Kyoto Protocol's legally binding commitments expire, part of them, the capping issues expire by 2012, because that was the second commitment period, so that is why we are renegotiating it, whether it's going to be an amendment, a new protocol, doing away with the protocol, doing another one, is up to the parties really to decide. But obviously it does need to be rejuvenated, if anything. I would like also to make a comment on what Peter said about the Climate Committee not having an earth scientist on the panel. I just make a clarification. I'm not saying that there isn't the need for investment in the earth sciences and possibly of having a member there, but to be fair, it is the committee very much works on the work of what the physics department has done. There has been a UNDP project going on for a number of years regarding Malta and its impacts on climate change, vulnerabilities, etc. So a lot has been done there. So there has been something. I'm not saying it's not there. A very positive thing is that the International Institute, Environmental Institute of the University of Malta, is working on organizing a master's in earth sciences. In fact, Perica Corpardo and I were discussing this issue before we started, and this would obviously be an investment in our generations and in Maltese citizens to start really, rather than start, to continue with working on the earth sciences. The other issues, Vanya, I'm sorry, because you are running so fast to make with the time, can you ask me again? Yes, can you ask me again what were your other two queries? Quickly, perhaps? I don't know, Chair, do we have the time?
I think we're running rather short of time, aren't
okay,
we? Now I'm being told by my colleagues at the
back. I'm sorry.
Maybe you can address
We can discuss it, yes, okay, for sure. Thank you.
Professor.
First of all, I'd like to just to make an optimistic comment. Technology may spring a surprise on us. At the beginning of the 20th century, London was overwhelmed with horses and solid waste of horses, and it was the biggest problem then. You know, I mean, London was drowning in solid waste. All of a sudden, the problem disappeared with the oncoming of the motor car. Now the motor car has created its own dangers, and I'm sure there are pressures now to develop new technology, and I'm very optimistic that it will be developed. That's point number one. Point number two, about EOSIS, which was mentioned earlier, this is a group of small island states. They're very influential. Although they represent about 1% of the world population, they're very influential. And in 1992, when the group was formed, Malta was offered the chairmanship, but we refused it at that time. Thank you.
You have just listened to the keynote speeches presented at the symposium entitled National Responses to Global Action, which was organized by the Department of International Relations at the Aula Magna in Valletta on January 7, 2010. Campus FM will proceed to broadcast the panel discussion today week.